Coming up on Boston Public Radio, it's a dream come true for shoppers, but a nightmare for state tax collectors. Yet another sales tax holiday is just weeks away in Massachusetts. Are you as excited as Marjorie or as upset as I am? Then, an MIT student on SWD, that's stress while driving, and whether road planners and car makers can fix it. Then, Edgar B. Herrick III gives us the bottom line on Boston's public bathrooms, Marjorie. Thank you.
Christopher Lydon on a very, very bad week for the First Amendment, and Kara Miller on very, very bad news for all you multitaskers. Think you can juggle email, texting, Facebooking, tweeting, and apps for everything under the sun? Well, new research says you may actually be frying your brain. Oh, no. Stay tuned for all that on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Eastern Browdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
You know what today is, Marjorie?
What? It's Thursday.
It is
July 25th.
Well, obviously it's Thursday, July 25th. It is the fifth.
Sometimes I'm not sure.
The five-month anniversary of Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan.
Congratulations, Jim.
Well, thank you.
You've earned every day.
Thank you very much. You know, Marjorie is experiencing exultation.
I am.
No more driving to New Hampshire to stuff a refrigerator in the trunk and sneaking back to Massachusetts to avoid the sales tax. No, because Massachusetts legislators appear poised to make August 10th and 11th sales tax free again. We have a bit of a disagreement in the studio as to whether or not this is anything more than a feel-good measure, Marjorie.
Is there something wrong with a feel-good measure, Jim? This is fun. You know what's great about it, too?
What?
It's your opportunity to fight back against the man for every time you've gotten a parking ticket, when the meter is broken, or when they've given you they pulled you over for a $50 or $75 ticket when your registration is like one day behind. This is your opportunity to have fun and get even.
When you say is there anything wrong, the answer is yes, $20 million of wrong. Here's the question for you all at 877-301-8970. While the official vote has not been taken, the Speaker of the House and the Senate President say it's going to happen next week. Does a sales tax holiday cause you to make purchases you would not otherwise make, in which case Marjorie's right, it's a success? Or, as I believe, does it simply cause you to postpone buying something you plan to go out and get, let's say, this weekend, in which case it is simply a $20 million drain on the state? Let me make my case here, Marjorie. If there's a full-page ad in the Boston Herald or the Boston Globe today that says, save 6.25%. Rush down to Macy's to buy a whatever, or rush down to Best Buy to buy a refrigerator. Do you think people are going to run in for a 6.25% savings? Of course they're not. And here's the alternative. The alternative is, oh, but Jim, wait a second. I wasn't going to buy that computer. I'm going to spend $1,000 on a computer and save $62. Here's my response to that, since I knew you'd bring it up.
Okay.
There are only two possibilities. Either you were going to buy the computer, in which case you just postpone the purchase, in which case the state just loses the money, or is anybody who says I can't afford $1,000 for a computer all of a sudden going to say, since I'm going to save $62.50, I'll go spend the $1,000 I didn't have before? It's ridiculous.
Here's the thing, Jim. Clever retailers who are in favor of this, obviously, are adding added incentives.
Some are.
They drop off
some
another
10%
discount. They maybe give you a 15% discount. Last year they gave you, these are little things that people love, these little things. They gave you all these free backpacks to run around shopping, and they gave you all these back to school and demonstrations, and styling demonstrations for the kids going back to school. And since you have to buy everything now, if you're a parent with kids in the public schools, except for the chairs and the desks, it's kind of fun to go out and load up on the Kleenex and the crayons and the magic markers and all those things you have to buy and get a great deal.
When I asked Governor
Patrick, deals on electronics too.
Last summer, when I asked Governor Patrick if he was going to sign this thing, and he said yes on our former radio show, and I asked him if he thought it made fiscal sense. What was his response?
I'm sure he said no.
He said no. It's a $20 million feel-good thing. 877-301-8970. Are you going to go out and buy something on August 10th and 11th that you would not have otherwise bought, which in which case it will stimulate the economy, it's good for business, And you will save, again, $6.25 on every 100.
You know, you are someone who obsesses over your Groupon things. You got some Groupon things from
guy.
A restaurant that I liked. You
yeah.
immediately
called
me up and said, oh,
favorite.
One of your favorite restaurants has a Groupon
50%
thing.
50% off.
Yeah, 50% off. A lot of retailers don't like Groupon either. You know that.
I know they don't.
They don't think it's a great deal for them.
Well, they're not forced to sign up, by the way. I know a lot
they're
of people.
They're not forced to sign up.
But Marjorie, there's a difference between a 50%.
It's a bargain, Jim.
Excuse me. A 50% discount through a coupon. Mm-hmm. As opposed to a 6.25% discount via the elimination of the sales tax for a weekend are two different animals.
You know, how do you keep describing this?
What's that?
As a feel-good.
Feel-good, yeah.
Feel-good.
$20 million.
Yeah.
$20 million. It's a lot of state money. It's $20 million.
Well, maybe we should concentrate on a little less graft and corruption. Maybe we could save a little bit, $20 million there, too.
Why don't we have a graft-free weekend after that?
Yeah, I'd love a graft-free weekend. This is a great deal for citizens to go out and get stuff, have fun, go with the kids, shopping right before school goes back, and you can feel like you are getting a deal, and for once, you're kind of getting even. 877-301-8970 is the number. 877-301-8970.
It's great before back to school. Now, let me ask you. Most mothers and fathers who are listening to the show, mm-hmm. you think they were contemplating buying back to school stuff anyway for their kid, or are they going to let them go without notebooks?
But they would prefer to get it on a weekend where there's not only no sales tax, but other added incentives.
If there are. Not everybody's doing it. Some of them are, some of them are not.
Added incentives. TJ Maxx, Marshall's, all these great stores. One was going from Kmart to, there's no more Kmart. Target. You'll have to go into Target. Mm. I mean, they're very smart retailers. You get the no sales tax, plus you get all these other goodies, plus you get hairstyling demonstrations. Who wouldn't want a hairstyling demonstration before back to school, Jim?
Okay, so the question is quite simple. Are you going to participate? And I assume a lot of you are. And if you do participate, is it a purchase you would not have otherwise made? And I think most of us agree. If the answer to that is no, then it is purely a giveaway of limited state dollars. No,
well,
it is.
You know,
Marjorie, I feel strongly
Let's
about this.
Let's raise the retirement age by six months.
Fine. Do
even
that too.
Six weeks, and then we can make up
They're
for it.
They're not mutually exclusive
You don't want
notions.
To raise the retirement age by 6 weeks.
Well, I would be open to talking about it.
I
would. Let's start in Fall River, which is the hometown of Marjorie Egan, where no statue has yet been erected, which is
not
ridiculous.
Yet.
Stephen, you're on with Marjorie Egan and Jim Browdy in Boston Public Radio. Thank you for the call.
Are you there, Steve?
Steven. We'll get to him in a second. 877-301-8970 is the number. Steven, you're now ready. Steven, welcome to Boston Public Radio.
Hi, guys. How you doing?
Excellent.
Great.
Thanks for calling.
I was just going to say, you might be able to recoup some of that tax money as income tax at the end of the year, so it might not be a totally $20 million loss.
You mean because the retailer will increase his or her profits? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, I know it's not much by just 2 days, but if they were to stimulate some purchasing power, they'll get the money back on the other end.
Now, Stephen, are you going to buy something you would not have otherwise bought on August 10th and 11th because of this sales tax holiday thing?
I wish I could, but I don't have any money. If I would have purchased a new computer or something.
Yeah, see, exactly. That's my point. Stephen, thank you, and I hope someday soon you have the money for mm-hmm. that new computer.
But you see, if the computer, say you get one of those what do they call those things?
Reconditioned.
Reconditioned computers. That's not what they call them, is it?
I know what you mean. But
it's a used
one. They don't call them used.
And they sell them at the Micro Center.
Yeah.
And they're
called they sell them everywhere.
Re-put together, whatever they are.
They're re-put together, that's the term.
Pre-owned
yes.
computers. You know, say you get the $500 computer mm-hmm. pre-owned, and then you get no sales tax on it, and then you get a 10% discount, and maybe you get another 10% discount on the other stuff over at Micro Center. You're talking about a happy day.
Marjorie.
This is a happy
day. You know how ridiculous this is?
You are bargain-obsessed. Every time I say to Jim, that's a nice shirt. Oh, it cost me $9.99 at REI.
Yes, it is.
Oh, nice shoes. I got them for $89 at such and such. You are obsessed with bargains.
I don't get
– where is the disconnect here? I know why.
Can I explain it to you?
I know why.
Why?
Because it's big – government.
No,
and
you know what
God
it is?
God forbid they lose
I'm
a dime.
I'm going to repeat what you just said.
Uh-huh.
You buy the $500 computer, you get the 6.25% off, and they give you another 10% off. Why don't you say they give you another 80% off? You're making it all up anyway. You have no idea what the extra incentives are going to be.
I read the stories, Jim. Yeah. Everybody gives extra incentives.
Some do, some don't. And again, if this was not a time, we just got over a fight. The legislature in both chambers, democratically mm-hmm. controlled, overrode the governor's veto, so he gets $500 million in new taxes for transportation infrastructure instead of $800 million in new taxes. And if people think, well, what's, you know, it's a lot of money anyway, well, look at the Longfellow Bridge. Look at the Anderson Memorial Bridge. Look at all this stuff that's fallen apart. You need money. So $20 million is not nothing, to use a phrase.
I have three words for you, Jim. waste, fraud,
and abuse
and corruption in government. Let's go to Maggie in Beverly. What do you think, Maggie?
Well, I think you guys make a great point about seasonal things affecting purchases. And mm-hmm. in the summertime, I vacation in Maine and go through New Hampshire, where I could make purchases in that state versus Massachusetts. So I think where people are vacationing and bargain hunters may want to do what you do, Marjorie, then this impacts people's decisions. Oh, I'll buy it in Massachusetts.
That's a great point. How about that, Jim?
Well, it's a border issue. But, Maggie, I have very bad news for you. You're probably not aware of this. If you buy an item in New Hampshire tax-free, do you know that when you file your income tax, state income tax the next year, you are legally supposed to report that you purchased that microwave? Do you know that, Maggie?
You know, my dad is a tax attorney, so I didn't.
Well, we've just reported your name to the Department of Revenue. Maggie, thank you for your call. I would agree,
Jim,
on the board. What?
Why don't you tell people about the time you tried to stuff the refrigerator?
I say this every year.
SUV
I never
that you purchased in New Hampshire.
I wouldn't do that.
And the state troopers pulled you over.
It's not. In my dreams, I've done that, but I have never done it, nor would I ever.
That's not what you told me, Jim.
No, it's a risky proposition. No, it is a risky proposition.
David from Worcester, should there be a tax-free holiday in Massachusetts, or should we listen to Scrooge over here that says never?
Scrooge and Deval Patrick, even though he signs it. Go ahead, David.
Yes, this is David in Worcester.
And, hi.
I want to agree with Marjorie about the fraud and abuse, but I want to say that she's maybe got it on the wrong side. My wife and I were at a vendor 2 days ago to buy some items for our home, household improvements, and the vendor offered, gee, if we pay cash, tell us there's an August 10th sale, we want to pay sales tax on it. There is fraud and abuse, but it mostly goes on in the private sector, not the government sector.
You know, by the way, David, when you said, the reason I laughed is you said you went to a vendor. I thought you said your wife and you went on a bender. And I was trying
to... That too. But that wasn't what I was calling about.
David, thank you for the call. I hadn't even thought of that, but that's another thing. They backdate these purchases so that you... You know, the problem... If you talk to most retailers, and I have, in past years, we've had people call us small business people who don't think this is such a great idea. And you know what they say?
What?
From the moment that the legislature announces they're going to do it, and yesterday the Speaker of the House said, we're going to do it next week. From that moment, July, whatever that was, 24th, I guess, from that point until August 10th, you know what these retailers are going to do? No business. Because everybody is going to wait. There'll be a flood on August 10th and 11th. I mean, they'll be flooding into the stores. And essentially, they'll sell virtually the same amount of stuff that they would have sold over a three-week period in a two-day period.
So
what are you smiling about?
Why don't you ban Black Friday shopping after Thanksgiving, Jim? Because that's the same thing that happens there. Everybody waits. Mm. Some people wait for days. They line up in parking lots, or they pay people to line up in parking lots.
Then they murder security guards. That, no, Black Friday's been a huge success, too, by the way. And by the way, let me just say one thing in defense of Black Friday. Even though the behavior of customers is really
What's
demented.
What's wrong with the behavior of customers?
Well,
they're not running over security
guards,
Jim.
You've spoken to them on the phone, as have I. And the behavior is just surreal. You know what the difference is?
Uh-huh.
Black Friday, the pluses of Black Friday, there's significant discounts. With the exceptions of what you keep saying, these added incentives, the underlying notion that a 6.25% discount is going to encourage anybody to do anything that they would not have done is preposterous.
Well, last year, Kmart was selling a 7-inch Android tablet for $89.99.
What's the normal
price?
And
by the way, the best story out of Black Friday, you know, lest we pass this by too quickly.
This is old. I know what you're going to talk about.
Is the woman who claimed that she was trampled at Walmart trying to buy a DVD player for $29.99, and we were all just appalled.
Knocked unconscious
by the
shoppers.
Her sister said they were like a herd of elephants running over her poor sister. And then we found out that the same woman claimed she had been trampled at four or five other Walmarts.
And it sued in many of those.
And sued, that's correct.
Our number is 877-301-8970. I mean, this is like a serious policy debate. It's only $20 million in a $34 billion budget.
Another excellent point, Jim.
It is really thrown away. By the way, our friend David Andelman from the Phantom Gourmet, his contention is that this is not enough. Why don't we extend it to meals? This doesn't apply, by the way, for we should have said this. It does not apply to cigarettes. Correct me if I'm wrong on this, Marty. It doesn't apply to automobiles.
It does not.
It does not apply to, what's the third
restaurants.
Thing? Restaurants.
It doesn't apply to things that are over $2,500 either.
Right, that's another good point.
So if you want to go out and buy, it doesn't apply to motorboats, but, you know, how many people are running out buying motorboats and expensive things like that. So that's fine. There's a $2,500 limit. Most of us are not out spending that kind of stuff on back-to-school supplies. Not yet, anyway, but that may be next. Dylan from Rhode Island, what do you think about a tax-free holiday? What is it, August 10th?
August 10th and 11th.
Yeah.
Hi,
hey, Dylan. Thank you guys for taking my call.
Thank you for making it.
I think that a tax-free holiday at this point isn't really in the best interest of the citizens of Massachusetts. I think if you put it around Christmas time, where people are going to be spending more money domestically, it's a little bit of a better idea. But as far as right now goes, in the middle of August, you're still going to have a bunch of people on the Cape. You're still going to have tourists on Martha's Vineyard and Nantucket, and that's kind of robbing them of the additional revenue they could get from out of state.
Hey, Dylan, here's a quiz from you, Dylan from Rhode Island. Our colleague Chelsea did a little research this morning. What state legislature, in its wisdom, has chosen not to have a sales tax holiday?
I would guess that would be the township of either Martha's Vineyard or Nantucket.
No, it would be the state of Rhode Island. Its legislature has decided not to do this, the place you're from, because it's penny-wise and pound-foolish, to use an overused expression. Dylan, thank you for a fine call.
Boy, you are a barrel of laughs today.
You're
a fun guy, Jim.
No, but you made a very good point before. So the people don't think—no one cares more about a bargain than I do. And I will be the first to admit it. You know, a good sale, but this is not a good sale. It is not
a new belt, Jim. How much you pay for that?
I got it for $9.99. But the only problem was, Marjorie.
What?
I had to wait for 11 years for the price to go down. It was 13. No, I will. You know, in the old days of filing space, one of the best discussions we ever had on the air with the outgoing mayor, Tom Menino. One day he was on with us and we talked to him about Filene's Basement because it's some state of transition there. It hadn't disappeared yet. And one of us said to him, do you do what I do, which everybody did? You know, you'd hide a suit the night before the markdown and you'd put it somewhere in the wrong size so people wouldn't find it. So it'd be there the next day for the markdown. And Menino told this great story about how his favorite salesman would do it for him. He'd tell the salesman which suits he liked. The salesman for Filene's Basement would put it in the wrong size so it'd be there the next day. So, you know, there's nobody who doesn't like a bargain. And I clearly am at the top of the list. This is not a bargain. It's bad for the state and doesn't save that much.
Okay.
And I'm telling you, it is not. If there's small business people out there, even though lines are full, try to get through, because I'm telling you, they're going to have barren businesses starting today up through August 10th.
One of the reasons it happens in the summertime is because
the
doldrums for sale. So this is a reason everybody's shopping at Christmas, obviously. Not that many people are shopping on the weekends in the summer, or maybe fewer people because they are on vacation. John from Sturbridge. Hi, John. What do you think about the tax-free holiday?
Hi. What it did for us, my wife and I, we've been talking for some time now about buying a new couch.
Okay.
So we saw a commercial on television that a nice furniture store is giving double the tax incentive. So what it does, it gave us the impetus to, okay, now we're going to go buy a new couch. And I know my wife, so I know when we get I've told her this, but I know we get there, the chairs we have aren't going to go with the new couch. So we're also going to have to buy chairs. So I figure if I can save 12% on buying, you know, probably a whole new room, it's a good thing.
So, exactly. John, give us an estimate.
John, Jim wants to take that away from
that
you.
Pleasure.
He wants you to pay the full freight.
No, I don't. John, give us an educated guess. We want to hold you to it. How much is that whole new living room going to cost? $1,200? What are you guessing?
Oh, no. It'll be more than that for the couch.
So let's assume it's $2,000.
I don't know if I should say the name of the furniture store, but it's a very nice furniture store, and they have good furniture.
Well, how much?
Sorry. I'd say we're going to spend $2,000 on a couch and probably $1,000 a piece on two chairs.
Okay. Only do $2,500, or maybe you can split it up. Let's assume it's $2,000 for argument's sake. You're going to save... you say it's going to be double, $240. So you're telling me,
that's great.
Wait a second, you're going to spend $2,000 that you thought you otherwise could not afford because you're going to save $240? Is that what you're saying?
Well, no, it wasn't we couldn't afford it. I could care less if we buy a couch, but my wife wants to buy a couch. So this just said, okay, we'll buy the couch.
Okay, well, that's a good argument.
Buying other things.
But
that's
also,
like the final nudge.
Yeah,
that's a good point,
John.
Thanks.
Thank you for the call. And also, you feel better. So you get $240. You can buy really high-end sneakers and have a really nice dinner out with your wife, right?
Yeah, he made a very good point, by the way. John, I hate to admit this, and this, I'm not sure it's good for people's personal economy. It's great for the economy. Even if you're not lured in, I can't believe I'm going to make your case now. If you're not lured in by the original purchase, the likelihood is good. If you go to a retailer that's got any skills and salespeople have any skills, you're probably going to buy other things. Now, the bad news is that you may not be able to afford those other things, but at least in the case, was John his name a minute ago? That is a fairly normal effect. So I guess that's a good deal. On balance, it's still ridiculous.
I'm sorry, it is. It's fun. People are looking forward to it. They're planning their purchases right now. Pete from Stoneham, what do you think about a tax-free holiday?
Oh, I'm totally on Jim's side on
this. Thank you, Pete.
Absolutely. This is my anecdotal experience from last year. I was in the market for an airless paint sprayer for my house. I watched the prices. I did my research. I looked at the local stores. I waited for the tax holiday. I went in to make my purchase. They jacked the price up 20% that week. I ended up paying more for the same paint sprayer. And I'm like, if I was a retailer, sure, that's exactly what I would do. I would take advantage of everybody's enthusiasm, and I'd raise my prices and hand gleefully take 6% off and walk away with a greater profit margin.
Pete, what is an airless paint sprayer?
It's used for spraying paint on large surfaces, like the exterior of a house.
Oh.
But it doesn't put any air into the paint. It just takes the paint up, sucks it up, and sprays it on the house.
You know, okay. Pete, what you described is probably illegal, but the thought that Martha Coakley, the Attorney General, has the resources to monitor that is insane. See, he makes a great – Pete, thanks for a call. He makes a great point, Marjorie. I hadn't even thought of this. Forget only saving 6.25% on a $100 item. The item is going to go up to $110 or $120 the day before, and they'll give you 6.25% off that. Not everybody, but some unscrupulous retailers.
We're getting some emails on this,
Jim. What are they saying?
I think some.
What's the email address, by the way?
BPR@WGBH.org.
Thank
I think some of our listeners are on to you.
What they say?
Stop the presses, says Jack. Jim is opposed to a decrease in taxes. He sees this as hurting Massachusetts. Well, I'm a resident of Massachusetts. It saves me money. That is good for me and bad for those who want to take my money.
Well, that's because you didn't pose to that emailer the follow-up question, which, again, the only question matters.
Uh-huh.
Are you going to make a purchase? And the answer is the guy's buying the couch. The answer to this is yes. Are you going to make a purchase you wouldn't have otherwise made? And if that's not the case, it's a total waste of time. Bonnie in Lexington, you're next on Boston Public Radio.
I look at it from a completely different perspective.
Please.
In that what our taxes pay for are things like firefighters and police. And I don't want a weekend free of those services. So I actually refuse to buy anything on the tax-free weekend because I don't want to – it just doesn't seem fair to me. I'm certainly not going to expect the police or firefighters not to work on those weekends.
Well, Bonnie, what if there was full transparency? What if it said on each item that when you buy this couch – you will lose 4 hours of a firefighter in your neighborhood. How about that? Or if you buy this blender, you're going to lose a you know, Bonnie makes a great point,
yeah.
And thank you for
I don't
the call.
Think we have to worry about
yes,
the police and firefighters. They're going to do their jobs. They're going to be well compensated for it, and they're not going to be hurt by the tax-free
This
weekend.
Is the last call we're taking on this. Laura's in Natick. You're on with Jim and Marjorie on Boston Public Radio. What do you have to say, Laura?
Hi. I am originally from North Carolina.
Welcome.
I've been in Massachusetts. Thank you. I've been in Massachusetts for a little over a year, and in North Carolina, we have been doing tax-free weekends for years. And from what I can tell, anyway, there seems to be a higher concentration of poorer people in North Carolina as compared to Massachusetts, maybe per capita.
We have one of the highest per capita incomes. We do, yes.
Exactly. So I don't necessarily agree with it because especially here, where the T system needs so much work, and I'm used to the metro system in D.C. because I live there as well, and I'm all about paying taxes, and if you're trying to help out people who can't afford certain products, there are much better ways that aren't going to affect the state as a whole.
Laura,
to do that, which is what they've been doing in North Carolina.
Laura, if you can call one of your friends in North Carolina and find out when the tax-free weekend is, Marjorie would like to fly down to buy a drill. Laura, thank you. For your call. See, there's proof from another state, Marjorie. It's just not working.
Well, I think Massachusetts can do a lot of tweaking in certain areas of state government to save millions and millions of dollars. And actually, I think we can take some credit here, you and I, or at least me. Well, you can't retire from the T anymore at 42 years old and collect a pension for the rest of your life. And I lobbied the governor, and he changed that rule, which is great. Anyway, new research up next out of MIT finds that driving around the city creates the same emotional strain on a driver as the anxiety that comes from skydiving. Stay tuned to find out what researchers and car manufacturers are doing to minimize the stresses behind the wheel. That conversation next on Boston Public Radio.
Adam Grant has burst onto the scene with some surprising findings about who ends up succeeding in their careers.
If you want to be a helpful, giving person, you don't have to be Mother Teresa or Gandhi. All you have to do is look for ways of adding a lot of value to other people's lives that cost you only a little.
Giving, taking, and how new research may change how we view the path to the top. I'm Kara Miller. That's on Innovation Hub tonight at 9 here on WGBH Radio.
This program is made possible thanks to you and Volkswagen, proud to support the Boston Globe WGBH Summer Arts Weekend presented by Citizens Bank. To find your closest Volkswagen dealership, you can go to vwdealer.com. That's the power of German engineering. And the 18th Annual Boston French Film Festival, showing at the Museum of Fine Arts now through July 28th. You can see award-winning films with stars Audrey Tautou, Isabelle Huppert, and more. Tickets at mfa.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. Anyone who is driving right now, how would you quantify your level of stress? Do you know where your anxiety levels would place you on the road frustration index? Yes, there is such a thing. Here with us to get at these questions is Cale Greco. He's a research assistant at MIT's Sensible City Lab. Cale, good to meet you. Thanks so much for coming.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Hi, Cale.
Hi.
So one of our coworkers said this morning that what he'd really like you MIT grads to be doing over there is figuring out how to put hood-mounted grenade launchers on everybody's car.
Huh.
But
because we can't get anywhere is the point.
Yeah.
The point he was making is how horrible traffic is.
Others of us, you know, would like to have a more zen-like experience behind the wheel. So what are you doing over there to reduce stress in driving?
Well, that's the thing. We're not actually focusing on the reduction yet. I mean, we're looking at how to quantify stress and frustration behind the wheel right now. So we're using skin conductance sensors. We're getting out in the cars, driving around, and really looking at what these triggers are that elicit the highest stress responses.
And apparently, according to the Globe story the other day, no one's done this stress. Everybody knows it's stressful, but no one's quantified the stress levels. Is that correct?
There have been studies that have looked at sort of the drive experience, but trying to quantify it in the way that we're doing it and trying to come up with this index that tells you kind of in real time how stressful and frustrating it would be to get out on the roads is completely new. And some of the technologies we're using in the car, we're using a hacked Microsoft Kinect to look at body movements, are completely novel as well.
And you're a guinea pig in this, are you not?
I am one of the first guinea pigs. Uh-huh. And I have to say I'm perfect for the task because if, you know, nothing else, I am an expert at getting stressed out. So especially behind the wheel.
Especially behind the wheel. But what, we saw the picture of you. Was that you with the stuff on your hands?
Yes. So the skin conductance sensors that I wear when I've been driving around actually fit around your palms to read sort of the sweat, essentially. That's the easiest way to understand it. When you get stressed out, you sweat a little bit in your palms, and these skin conductance sensors are able to detect these micro fluctuations in stress levels through the sweat.
And we all knew that city driving was stressful, but one of the amazing things, at least in your case, and obviously in this case is anecdotal because it's just you, but I know the research is broader than that, your stress levels were higher driving than they were in virtually anything you did, including taking courses, exams, other than one thing, correct?
Yeah, that is absolutely
what was the
right
one thing?
Well, the one thing was skydiving. So, I mean, what we did when we started these trials, we were just amazed. And this is, I mean, one of the reasons that this kind of study is so important is we all intuitively understand that driving is stressful.
Sure.
So this is not a surprising element of the study to just come out and say like, yeah, listen, driving will stress you out. But we were just completely surprised at how stressed people would get.
Just getting in the car, from what I read.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
Forget driving. Getting in the car and anticipating the driving experience.
I mean, you are completely locked in to reading as many signals as you can. There's a lot going on in the car. There's just so many things to be keeping track of, be aware of. So it's a very stressful environment. And we saw this immediately. We were very surprised and shocked. And so I started wearing these sensors during every other daily activity I could think of. So that was wearing them to some of my more stressful courses, when I was public speaking, when I was talking about the project, you know, and driving, the stress response we noticed from driving just dwarfed everything
else. How's your stress level right now?
I would say it's probably pretty high. But okay. I'm not wearing a sensor, so there's no way to corroborate that.
But tell us about the skydiving thing. I mean, yeah. It seems a little far to go. I would be petrified to skydive. How did you end up skydiving?
That's interesting because, yes, I was petrified as well. So, I mean, in the lab, as we were talking about, as I was, like, presenting on the research, I had other Sensible City lab members who were suggesting, oh, you need to compare it to this. You need to compare it to that. And it became a running joke eventually. They, you know, whoever could throw out the most extreme thing that I could test, you know, would kind of win the battle. And eventually, the Sensible City lab director, Carlo Rotti, suggested skydiving, jumping out of a plane. And I thought it was a joke. And
which you'd never done
before. I've never done it before. We needed an authentic experience, mm-hmm. you know, to compare. Yeah, I absolutely thought this was a joke. I resisted. I was like, oh, no, this is crazy. Why would I do this? But eventually, you know, I turned and I thought, you know, for the good of science, let's get out there. Let's jump. And so I went up to Pepperell Skydive up in like at the border of with New Hampshire and mm-hmm. Massachusetts. And I got in a plane and I took the plunge.
You know, okay. Now, we know it has to be very stressful while you're waiting to take the plunge.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But was it fun after the parachute opened?
So, yeah, I mean, when I looked at the stress response actually from skydiving, the highest response obviously was jumping, was like falling right. out of the plane. And then the second peak, the second highest peak was when the chute opened. And then after that, it was nothing. It was just, it was really, really, really exciting. And I felt really great when I was
okay.
You know
what
the highest
down.
Level is when the chute doesn't open.
That's
we're talking to Cal
Greco.
I don't
want to test that. But.
Cal Greco from MIT is doing this research on stress while driving. Now, you said to Marjorie up front, your goal, even though we want to talk about this in a minute, is not to figure out how to fix or undo the stress. Your goal is to quantify it, figure out what causes the most stress. Are you able to discern from your research what part of the driving experience is theoretically most stressful to people?
I mean, that's what we're looking at. It's still coming together. We have some anecdotal results, but we're really seeing we're seeing that it's really all tied to loss of control in a car. So when you don't really understand roadway conditions, you don't understand the rules of the road where you are. If you get lost, you have a very high stress response.
So horrible signage might be.
Horrible signage is one, you know,
traffic
aspect.
Jams, I assume.
Traffic jams, of course. It's areas where there are a lot of bikers and pedestrians mm-hmm. elicit a higher stress response.
They do.
Yeah.
But I assume, though, that the skydiving was off the charts compared to the driving. Or am I not?
They were somewhat comparable. So when
they were comparable?
Well, let me say this. Comparable to one of my trials. So in one of the very first trials I went on, I actually got in a car accident. And so I've been in, like, maybe three accidents in my life. And to capture this for the study was quite remarkable.
Was it your fault?
No, it wasn't my fault. And we had cameras everywhere in the car, so okay. I was able to, you know, show.
By the way, what I hear about that, Marjorie, is the woman he mentioned before, who's head of the MIT Sensible City Lab, said, Cale, go out and get in a car accident. Let's see how
I was terrified when it happened because on the one hand, I was like, I wrecked one of the cars for this study. But at the same time, I was kind of excited because we must have this really great data. I don't know what this is, but it's going to be amazing to look at.
So how did it compare with the skydiving?
It was comparable. The skydive was definitely higher, but
the highest.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
But the accident itself was quite off the charts as well.
Our number is 877-301-8970. Since they're doing the research over there, why don't you guys call in and let Cale know what you find to be the most stressful circumstances while you're driving? Because ultimately the goal, Cale, from what I understand, is to have road planners and car makers. I know you're doing this with Audi.
Yes.
Car makers and road planners figure out how do we redesign roads, how do we redesign cars to attack the stress-creating circumstances
Absolutely.
That you're identifying. Is that
Absolutely.
Not the ultimate goal?
Yes.
Okay. I'm sorry, Marjorie.
But what I was going to ask you, though, so let's say that the skydiving stress was 100%
mm-hmm.
and maybe the car accident was like 80%.
Mm-hmm.
Is that about right?
It's,
or is it
it's
half?
Hard to – it's – I mean, because they're like the skydive was just magnitudes
okay.
higher than everything else.
What I'm trying to get at is how much more stressful is getting in a car accident or skydiving than just sitting in traffic on Starrow Drive? Is it like 10 times more stressful, 20 times more stressful?
I mean, I couldn't give you an exact figure, but
okay.
but skydiving was far more stressful.
Okay.
But the accident itself was in the range that was comparable.
Okay.
I would say.
And is everybody stressed because I like to drive. I mean, I don't like sitting in traffic.
Sure.
And I really hate it. And this is my big pet peeve when people drive in the left lane on the highway.
There she goes.
I think we should tase those people.
No, they're driving in the left lane if they're not driving faster than everybody
right,
else.
If they're not passing. Because everybody does that now. Driving absolutely nuts. It drives me nuts. But other than that, I like driving. So I don't feel like I'm stressed driving.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, everyone has a different response. I mean, part of the study and what we do is we take a baseline so we understand sort of the magnitude of change when driving. So we can still detect these fluctuations in stress response from person to person.
Uh-huh.
And it changes. But, you know, overall, we can get this average of stress response, and we can still identify these core triggers.
You said that you mentioned triggers. The thing that has hit home most with me while you're speaking, Cale, is it is the loss of control. I mean, I'm as Cale's speaking and you're talking, Marjorie, I'm saying to myself, what are the most stressful circumstances I find myself in? And it's all the ones where you don't control things. Your GPS is working or it's not working, or it's, you know, that once a month when your GPS goes nuts and you have no idea how to go to a place you ordinarily go to, or you're stuck in Jeff Keating and I from Greater Boston talk every day about getting here from Cambridge. And it's not because we don't know how to drive here from Cambridge. It's because every bridge is shut down or there's one lane.
Yeah,
you have no control over the circumstances.
The hood-mounted
grenade
launchers.
I don't know if we should out him exactly. Let's take a few calls for Cale, helping his research. 877-301-8970.
Jeff on Cape Cod, what do you think about stress while driving, Jeff?
Oh, I agree. The loss of control is an issue. People are trying to get somewhere when they're driving. And if something slows them down or detours them, then they've lost that control and now they might be late.
Yeah.
That's it.
Absolutely. But you know, but we've got a great question from Christopher.
If on the email?
And I think this is true, at least for me. Yeah. How do talking or texting on the phones, which you're not supposed to do, obviously, texting while you're driving, contribute to this? I feel myself as if I'm talking on the phone, getting some business done, then it's not so bad to be stuck in traffic because at least I'm accomplishing something.
Hmm. Yeah, we have not looked at that at all yet,
yeah.
I have to say.
I bet that's true, though, that you're less stressed if you're doing something.
I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, I think you're engaged in a different way, so you still might see this stressful arousal that you wouldn't attribute to an anxiety kind of stress, but you were still this activity that you could measure would still be there in some capacity, I'm sure.
You know what also, you know, talk about getting stuck in traffic. I feel like I should join the Sensible City Lab at MIT. It'd be interesting to compare, and I'm sure you're doing a variation on this theme now. Let's assume because of horrible traffic, it takes you 45 minutes to get from X to Y, even though it's only 5 miles away. If you know that's the situation every day, if you take a totally roundabout route, which is 3 times as long, but you know it's going to get you to where you need to go in the exact same period of time, but without traffic blockage.
Yes.
My guess is you're stressful. Yeah. Isn't that exactly?
Yeah. So, I mean, our grander vision with this project is to really bring in emotional intelligence into the equation of intelligent transportation systems. So, you know, as a society, we've dumped tons and tons of resources into getting people as quickly and efficiently from point A to point B. And we want to take in the emotional aspects of that and really look at, well, how can we qualitatively get them there in a better way? So what if you have to spend 2 to 3 extra minutes on your drive home, but it's a much more pleasurable, enjoyable experience? Would you do it? I would. You know?
So how does this work? How many of you are driving around in these cars with these little gadgets on your hands, measuring how much your palms are sweating? How many of you are doing this?
So right now it's internal in the Sensible City Lab. We've really been defining and developing this the methodology itself.
Okay.
So it's been lab members and friends of the lab.
Okay.
And the hope next step is to scale this up, do it citywide, get participants from all walks of life behind the wheel, and bring it all together. And so
you want to volunteer right here?
Oh, yeah, please.
I am so ready
for
this. It
would be fantastic. Let's get you out there.
And how long do you think before you have any big-time results in how we can be more zen-like behind the wheel? Months, years?
It would be a matter of months if we focused on getting the trials up and running as they are now. I mean, we really have a good a system developed to measure and pull all these things together. And so it would be a matter of time before a matter of months before we're actually mapping the stresscapes of Boston.
You should test a colleague of mine who shall remain unnamed. I'd say 50% of the time is driving her car without a rear bumper. And I'm not going to name names, Marjorie. Now, that let's go back to the Coles. 877 happens to be true. 877-301-8970. Alyssa in Arlington, you're on with Cale Greco from the MIT Sensible City Lab. Hey there, Alyssa.
Hi.
Hi.
I love this subject. It's so interesting because I changed jobs last year, and one of my motivators was a long commute. I was commuting 25 miles each way, and I switched to commuting 8 miles, but in fact, my commute stress has gone up. And I was trying to figure out why that was, but in talking and listening to y'all, I realized I was commuting 25 miles around 128. Mm. We all go really fast. We all go in the same direction. We all know what we're doing.
Yeah.
And it was pretty consistent. I'm commuting through Medford and Chelsea and Boston, and nobody seems to know what they're doing on a daily basis, and my commute ranges now from 25 minutes to an hour and 10 minutes. So when I get in the car every morning, I never know when I'll be to work.
Yeah, and that's
very stressful.
That's another thing we've noticed is this change in road type. So if you're going from highway to, you know, inner city downtown driving to suburban driving, this change really triggers a stronger stress response as well. If you're just on a highway the whole way, you get comfortable, you get used to it, you know what you're doing, and you're
You know,
right.
My stress level went up just listening to Alyssa.
Alyssa made a great point, though, not knowing whether you're going to be at work in 25 minutes or an hour is a big deal.
That's the loss of control thing that Cale was talking about.
Loss of control. And the inability to plan is really upsetting, too. And sitting behind red lights. You know, it's really funny in the summertime in Boston.
Alyssa, thanks for the call.
When the school's out, one of the beauties of school being out, you never get stuck behind a school bus.
That's a very fine point.
It's a very fine point.
You know, we talk
it's
a lot about
my summer commute, so much more enjoyable.
We talk a lot on the show, and GBH did this great series on the intersection between cyclists and drivers. But I'm so glad you added to the list, particularly in urban areas, as there's an expansion of cycling.
Absolutely.
The stress that is created by having cyclists on these packed, narrow roads is really... it's out of control. Kyra, you're in Concord. You're on with Jim and Marjorie and Cale Greco from MIT. Hey, Kyra.
Hello, Jim and Marjorie. And is it Tim? Is that
Cale?
Cale, I'm sorry. Pardon me, Cale.
No problem.
Pardon me. Hi, Cale.
Hi.
And Jim and Marjorie, thank you for taking my phone call.
Pleasure. Thank you.
I really like the topic, and it's pretty apropos to my travels, which I do readily. However, I do plan and can definitely relate to Alyssa in some way. However, I definitely plan accordingly. I'm a health aide and CNA. I like to drive often, and I find that, however, I'm driving, I do find that I drive quite a distance sometimes to the residences or to the agencies where I go for my work, business. However, even saying that, I find sometimes that the conditions and just in terms of the conditions of the roadways and just drivability, it's unbelievable how some people vary in their drivability.
But you found a way to reduce stress while you drive?
Yeah.
How do you do that?
Well, the first thing, Marjorie, honestly, and Jim and Cale, is that what I find is that you definitely give yourself time accordingly as to where you're going to be driving.
I think that's a great point.
You know, and then also, when you do have those yield signs, even though the other person may not be yielding, that's coming on to the oncoming traffic on the highway, just know that you're doing what you're supposed to be doing.
You are so calm, Kyra. I can't imagine you being stressed ever.
Thank you very much for the call.
Thank you for the call. She made a great point, though. The first point is if you're not doing... like, for example, Marjorie, if I got up at 6 a.m. to leave for work every day, what's this? Go ahead, tell me what it
that
is.
You leave early.
I do.
So that you get there early. And if you're early, you sit in the car and you read your emails or you text or whatever you do. And then you don't have to
stress.
Or
I meditate, whatever.
Or you meditate. That's right, Jim. Chance, in the parking lot. And you do those things so you're not worried about being late.
So, Cale, if people want to find out about, is this online somewhere?
Yeah, absolutely.
Where do they go? What do they do?
So they can go to our website, sensible.mit.edu.
How is sensible place? S-E-N-S-E,
A-B-L-E, yes.
Okay.
That's great.
.mit.edu. Yes.
Hey, Cale Greco, this is great. Good luck. Let us know when you draw
Thank
this
you
thing
so
to a head.
Yeah, we want the results.
Oh, yeah,
results
absolutely.
When you get them.
And I am volunteering, and I'm not kidding.
You want to jump out of a plane, too?
No, thank you, Cale. I think that's only so far we
Cale
go.
Is a research assistant at MIT's Sensible City Lab. Thank you so much again, Cale. Okay, you think driving in Boston is stressful? Well, one thing that could stop that stress is finding a public bathroom around here. This is a conversation we had a few weeks ago. Since then, Edgar B. Hurwick, our investigative reporter, has investigated the state of the city's paid toilets. His update is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio. And we're taking your calls at 877-301-8970.
Some of the best musicians on the planet are coming to the American Ballroom at the Westin Copley Place this Saturday for the Boston Globe WGBH Summer Arts Weekend After Dark, presented by Citizens Bank. Like folk rock supergroup Session Americana, Brooklyn Indian funk band Red Barat, plus Carlos Nunez, Ryan Montblou, and the amazing Miss Angelique Kidjo. But act fast, tickets are extremely limited. Visit bostonsummerarts.com to learn more.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and Samets Blackstone Associates for more than 30 years helping businesses and nonprofits tell their stories and build relationships through integrated brand strategy, design, and digital media. You can follow them on Twitter at SAMETZ. And Subaru of New England, introducing the all-new redesigned Subaru Forester with all-wheel drive. Love, it's what makes a Subaru a Subaru. More information available online at SubaruofNewEngland.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. A few weeks ago, maybe a month ago, we talked about how hard it is to find a public bathroom in the town. For background research, at the time we called the mayor's office to find out about the status of those paid self-cleaning toilets where everybody ballyhooed them, I think 12 years ago. The city couldn't tell us how many were still functioning or where they were. So the man behind the curiosity desk, that's of course Edgar B. Hurwick III, took it upon himself to find out. He reported on this earlier this week for Greater Boston. You know, Marjorie, you know this is a longtime report. Every reporter's goal is to be the top expert on something. Edgar B. Hurwick III is now, this is amazing, he stands alone, is the man in the know on public toilets in Boston.
The
Welcome back,
pundit.
Edgar. The potty pundit, that's exactly
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely. It's been great reporting on this, Edgar, and
Thank
I'm
you,
thrilled
Marjorie.
That you're here to give us the update on the state of the public toilets in Boston.
Yeah, I was just out again today, but let me back up and just talk a little bit about kind of what led us to this. You guys obviously did a great piece on this here on Boston Public Radio, and as you said, Jim, you know, we were like, well, this shouldn't be too hard to find out. Let's go find out. So we got on the city website. And they had it listed that they had six of these pay to play toilets. These put a quarter
pay
in
to
use
play.
Use the toilet. So we were like, all right, six. We can do that. Let's go look at all six and see what the status of these things are. See how they work, right? Mm-hmm. Well, it turns out we went out earlier this week, and five out of the six were not operating. Mm. Five out of the six. And in fact, we were out and talking to people about how difficult it is to find a public restroom, how difficult it is to use these particular restrooms. Here's a little bit about what we heard just from people who were out on the street earlier this week.
It was hard to find the restroom.
You know, there aren't really public bathrooms around here.
If I have to go, I don't know. Basically, it doesn't happen.
A lot of time, there's a lot of water.
And there are no fixes and nothing.
Sometimes you kind of have to suck it up and ask the restaurants if we can just sneak in there.
They yeah. no fix nothing.
The thing you don't get in hearing that guy say that is that he actually physically did the Italian
yes.
guy hand thing on
we
the chin.
The
they don't
thing,
fix
yeah.
a nothing.
Well, you know what I was thinking about this when I saw your great piece on Greater Boston? We talked to you about this before. Say you are one of those efficient tourists or travelers, and you know where the six toilets are,
yep.
and you're out for the day.
You got your guidebook that tells you where they are, right?
Great point.
And the kids say, I have to go to the John, Mommy, I have to go to the John. And you say, oh, sweetheart, the toilet is right up here. And
yep.
you get to the toilet, and all the kids are anticipating using this toilet, and it doesn't work. Can you imagine?
Yeah.
I mean, you've got three
Once
little
you stop
kids on your hands.
Once you stop holding it, that moment you stop
Beautiful
holding
it.
Yeah,
quote,
you're in big trouble.
Yeah. Now, Edgar, there's more bad news. That people are probably listening saying, well, the good news is at least one of the six
Yeah.
is operating. But I saw you on Emily's show. It's
yeah.
not as good news as it sounds, correct?
No, it is a pretty brutal experience inside of that one that was operating
Where is it?
The one that was working is in the North End,
okay.
Kind of near where that pool and baseball field mm-hmm. are on the north side of the North End. And it works in quotes, right? They're self-cleaning and self-sanitizing. That's how they're supposed to operate. by the smell of things in there, you could not say that it was clean. And you could not, by the state of the toilet, you could not say that it was sanitized. Now, I will say this. We went back out today. So yesterday, I finally got somebody on the phone. And I want to talk about this a little bit. There's a guy named Peter O'Sullivan. And he runs what's called the city's Coordinated Street Furniture Program. And this bathroom thing is a part of that, right? And so this is the bathrooms, but it's also a lot of the bus shelters, kiosks. And basically, he's the guy from the city. But the whole thing is operated by a company called J.C. Ducot. Okay. Now, these guys are not only responsible for making sure there's advertising in these kiosks and that there's up-to-date maps, but they're also responsible for maintaining the toilets. Now, in my conversation with him, here's how it works. The city doesn't pay for these things, right? They didn't pay for them to be installed. So it's a win for the city. This company, they were once called Wall. J.C. Ducot bought the contract from Wall. But they paid for them to be installed, and they pay for them to be maintained.
So what do they get out of it?
They get the revenue from the advertising. Mm-hmm. They get the quarters that go into the slot for the toilets. And then the city gets back from them a cut, a percentage of their revenue, and also a flat fee. So over the course of this program, the city has made upwards of $16 million. So it's a win for the city. J.C. Ducot's doing
well.
What,
$16 million from quarters people put in and never got the door to open?
Well, but also from a cut from the advertising that J.C. Ducot makes, right? So here's the thing. This should be a win-win-win program, right? The city should win because they get toilets and they get a company that's maintaining them for them. J.C. Ducot should win because they make revenue. And the people should win because there should be toilets working. But here's the thing. It's a win-win, not win. Because what's happening is J.C. Ducot's making money. It's clear. The city's making money. But the toilets aren't working, so people can't use the toilets. It's kind of crazy. And look, I had a long conversation with Peter O'Sullivan. He sounds like a great guy. He sounds like a hardworking guy. He said, look, I want to be clear. This is a challenging program, but we're working with J.C. Ducot. They're maintaining these things daily. Our relationship with J.C. Ducot is strong. And then yesterday he said to me, on the heels of our report on Greater Boston, he said, look, we went out today. We have 7 of the 8. By the way, there was 8. Oh, this is the other thing. The city website said there was 6. And when I finally got him on the phone, he said, listen, there's 8. We just updated the website. There's actually 8 of them. So we went to 7 of the 8 today. Now, he said to us yesterday that 7 of the 8 are going to be were operating yesterday. That's what Peter told me. And I was like, that's great. That's really great news. We went back out today. Of the 7 that we visited today, 5 of them were not operating. Again.
Wait, had told you that they would be operating?
He said that yesterday they were. And today, 5 were not. And here's the thing. They might have been operating yesterday. What I'm starting to learn about these is that they're incredibly temperamental. They were made by a company in Germany. He explained to me that sometimes when they break, they have to go to Germany to get the parts. They have to wait for the parts to come from Germany. They got to go in and they got to fix them. You know, I said, it sounds to me like if these were just plain bathrooms, not state-of-the-art bathrooms that automatically open doors, that have music come on, that have self-flushing, that have self-cleaning. If they were just plain regular bathrooms, it seems like it would be cheaper and easier to maintain
them. You mean to hire someone to clean the things?
Well, sure. If you've got to have people who are on stage, apparently J.C. Ducot, who I've called and I haven't heard back from them, I'm trying to get somebody from that company on the phone to tell me, do you have people on this full-time? How many man hours are you spending on actually maintaining these toilets? Because whatever they're doing isn't working. Listen to this. Apparently, what I heard from Peter O'Sullivan was that there's one of these bathrooms by the aquarium, and that it's one of the most used bathrooms in the world. So, you know, he said, this is challenging, but we're on this every day. And I believe him. It sounds like he's doing everything he can to keep these things operating. But he said this is one of the most used bathrooms in the world. I get there today. I got the camera. We're gonna try this bathroom out, right? I put a quarter in. I hear a woman out of my right ear. Sir, 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 sir. You know that's not gonna work, right? I walk up to her. She's a woman. She's a young lady who works at a kiosk. She says, "I see people put quarters in there all day long. I've been working here for 2 months. I have yet to see those doors open."
So
I mean, this is
so. Where's
crazy.
The disconnect so
it's
here?
Just, and you know, you may say it's a win for the city, but not when people feel bad about
right.
the city
it's true.
Of Boston.
It's true. I mean,
here.
On one hand, I look at it and I say, you know. If this program didn't exist, the bathrooms wouldn't be there at all, and none of them would be – so any one bathroom use, even if it's only one a year that happens, is a net gain in
some
way of
looking at it? Well, except for the point that
it.
You and Marjorie made before, and you – you responded to Marjorie's point a little more graphically than I would have, but I think most people can relate to the notion when you know a bathroom is at X location,
yep.
you physiologically
That's right.
get ready. I don't know how to put this for the experience. Everybody
right.
knows what I'm talking about. And if you get there and you are, let's put it this way, the experience is denied,
yeah.
you are really
and
in serious you know what.
If you are a 3-year-old or a 5-year-old, 7-year-old kid, there yeah. goes the
no,
whole day out with the family.
When this happened, long before we knew you, Edgar, I remember having read, when, you know, the beginning of the century when they were doing these, that these had existed in other communities, maybe
right,
in Europe or something.
Yep.
Are they working there?
It sounds like these things are – it's. I mean, these. This particular company, Wall, has made bathrooms like this for other cities. It sounds like this particular model, for lack of better saying it, is a little bit of a challenge. You know, they said they had that J.C. Ducot, this is what Peter O'Sullivan told me. He's the guy in the city who runs mm-hmm. who sort of coordinates the program. He said that they brought technicians in from Germany a few weeks ago. They had to bring technicians in from Germany to get them all up to working order again. And again, by today, five of these
yeah, this is not
working.
The NASA program.
Apparently
it's a public
it is.
Bathroom.
There are so many moving pieces on these. You put a quarter in, the thing opens up, and then it sort of tells you, you know, adjust the toilet, and then you go in, and the doors close, and it senses that you're there, and these lights come on, and this music comes on, and then it's, you know, there's an automatic sink. It does. I don't think they
why
need all these bells and whistles. They have clearly made something that
too
is
complex.
Way too complex
yeah,
and needs to be maintained all the time.
But
which is
but
my question.
Should,
why not just make a higher-end porta-potty? Everybody hates
that's
porta-potties.
What
that's what I'm saying.
And they're gross.
Because then anybody could maintain it, right? And here's the thing. Two more of these are going to go in by 2026. As per the contract that was signed, the contract ends in 2026, the contract that J.C. Ducot bought from Wall. And there are going to be two more of these things installed. And I asked Peter, are you going to install the exact same ones, which we already now know you have serious problems with? He said, there's language in the contract that there's some kind of upgrade in technology. They're allowed to upgrade them.
You know what's going to happen like in 10 years? The good news is we'll have 30 of these. The bad news is none of them will work.
Steven just emailed and said the stress rating for the mom with the kids needing to go potty who finds an out-of-order bathroom is greater than the stress of skydiving.
I'm sure it is. So, Edgar, you want a little advice from me?
Yes, please,
about your
Jim.
Career trajectory?
Because,
you know, I'm very
do.
Fond of you.
Thank
I'm thinking as you're speaking, your last two reports have been these. One, you jump into the Charles River with a toxic bottom. And that was two reports ago. And your next investigative report was going into public bathrooms.
That's true.
I mean,
your question
you know, there
is
a certain
dirtier,
thing
the
going
Charles
on
or
here.
The public restrooms.
So, you know, the larger theme here, I mean, one of the problems, and I know it's your piece for Emily's show is fabulous.
Thanks.
By the way. It was really great. And people should watch it and get it online.
It's online.
The problem, the underlying issue, the reason we're discussing this is when you come to a city, particularly a city that is visited by so many tourists
yeah.
or people who live outside of Boston who come to shop or
that's
eat
right.
or that sort of thing, public restrooms are a huge need. It's not
yeah.
like a luxury.
The
it's
Freedom
a,
Trail.
It's a necessity.
The whole
remember
Freedom
that story in the Globe?
Trail,
yeah.
there's no place to
yep.
go to the bathroom. How many people come here? By the thousands.
Yep.
So
12 million, they say, the city says 12 million tourists a year. 12
million.
Million.
Okay, so we're not going to go into this
they
in great
depth. They
have
to go to Revere to
while,
go to the bathroom.
While we are waiting for the city to live up to its obligation of this company, whatever this company's
J.C.
name
Ducot.
Is, what are the Edgar B. Herwick III recommendations as to what the alternatives?
Well,
what do people do?
Here are the tips. Here are the, you know, public spaces like the public library in Copley, great option. Clean bathrooms, they don't mind if you use it. Places like City Hall, you can go inside and go to the bathroom. That's a good option. Hotels, people tell
hotels
us,
are the best.
Are the best option, right?
You have to beg,
but you have to look like you belong.
You just
the, yeah,
well,
you
that's
do.
The key. You go in and you just yeah. act as if you know you've
yeah.
been checked in there for 2 days, and you walk right, you know, sort of pretend like you know where you're going until you find the bathroom. Walk with confidence until you find.
Can I tell
it,
you
right?
something? I don't
bars
use,
are another one. I use bars a lot
since because, you started yeah. the graphic discussion. Let
yes.
me just bring it to a head here. Sometimes one has to go so bad, it's worth renting a room if you have to. But, okay. So what is the – so it's hotel. I'm sorry.
Hotels.
It's hotels.
Public spaces like a, you know, like a library or city hall or mm. South Station. Some people said South Station is a good option. And by the way, we have a map up on our website, WGBHnews.org,
oh,
yeah.
where this piece is, which we want to kind of be a living, breathing resource of a map. So if people have tips, head to the website and put in the comment section where you know if there's a good bathroom somewhere that people can use around
town. But again,
town.
You know, think about it. You go down to the Swan Boats with the little kids again
yeah.
or you go see the little Makeway for
yeah.
ducklings. And it's hard to look – you know, like you belong there if you got three little kids all a mess going into the Four Seasons Hotel right across the street.
You're right. It's much harder with families.
If you're
me, I can pretend. I can walk into a bar or I can walk into a hotel. But if I'm a family, and the families that we've talked to when we were out in Boston, they say for the most part they have to eventually suck it up and ask a restaurant.
Yeah.
And that's not fair to the restaurant.
You know what the solution
is? That's
not
fair to the family.
You know, in the next week or so, where I think we're going to be talking to virtually all the mayoral candidates, I don't mean this as a joke. There's got to be some deal. You know, just there are lots of conditions when you open a private business or you construct a piece of real estate. Part of the deal, if you want to build in this city or want to open in the city, has got to make things accessible to the public.
We have to back the public toilet candidate.
And I'm serious.
Well,
I mean,
don't forget, Jim, one of the things that the city is pushing for as part of its, you know, kind of larger way they want people to be living their lives here with things like Hubway and things like bike trails is more people biking, more people taking the T, fewer people driving, which means more pedestrians, which means more people walking, which means more people who need a place to go to the bathroom. So it's not just going to be tourists. And this problem is going to increase.
You know, let me tell you one funny thing about your piece for Emily's show for Greater Boston is if you all haven't seen it yet, at the beginning of the thing, Edgar is sitting in the driver's seat of a van or something as you're on your way. And to show that he is in need, he's got a huge water bottle, and he has what he says. This is, you'll understand where I'm going here in a second. What he said is an empty coffee cup, which represented his second cup of the day. I thought you had the empty coffee cup in case you couldn't find it. No, I honestly did. But in fact, it was to demonstrate that there was. So let me ask you finally here. I assume you're going to keep going out and checking out these places to make sure the city's living up to its obligation?
We're going to keep an eye on it, absolutely. And again, I want to say that it sounds, you know, Peter O'Sullivan, it sounds like, is doing what he can, that he's working hard. And he says...
Yeah, but the bottom line is that...
He says
I mean
that him
that
and J.C. Duco, that there's a strong relationship and that they work to maintain these daily.
How can there be a strong relationship, Edgar? Yesterday he told you they're all working. You go there today and virtually none of their work.
Because,
what kind of relationship
because
is there?
I really think that these units are so flawed and so temperamental that I believe him that they could have been working yesterday. And what happens, because the whole thing's supposed to be automated, is somebody does something that sets it off, it doesn't reset, and it doesn't work. And they don't – and I think that my suspicion is – and I'll come back when I can confirm this with J.C. Duco. My suspicion is that they don't have enough people, given how often these things need to be maintained.
They need to have a little person living inside the toilets who can be there.
I mean, I don't know what the answer is, but they clearly are not up to the task right now.
I don't want to break confidence, but for those who – this was a great report. Edgar's next piece, which we're told not to mention, he's doing a history of the urinal, which I – when will that be airing? What are you – Edgar B. Herrick III, you're the best.
Thank you, Jim.
What do you call
thank
those
you
things?
So much. What's that? Those little cakes.
Urinal cakes, yeah.
Yes.
We're going to do a –
We're going to do an investigation
on urinal cakes.
Goodbye, Edgar. And it really is. You got to go watch. It is fabulous. Go to Emily's website, Greater Boston, and check it out. It's great.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Edgar
B. Herwick III is the man behind the Curiosity Desk. Thank you very much, Edgar. Okay. First Amendment has taken a real beating over the last week. Christopher Lydon joins us for Open Mic to go over the 3-prong attack against freedom of the press.
I'm James Edwards. I live here in Brighton, and I report here in Boston. Well, I do this because of the accountability.
The chamber's salary is far and away the highest in the state. And I would say that one of the reasons for that is that it is the largest, probably most complex, urbanized environment in the state that has a city manager form of government.
Me sticking with journalism is sort of the work and kind of that sense of public good in a way. James Edwards, WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Funding for our programs comes from you. And Blue Man Group at the Charles Playhouse, proud to sponsor the Boston Globe WGBH Summer Arts Weekend. Blue Man Group celebrates the arts with extended summer performances every day of the week through the end of August. Information at blueman.com. And This Old House, this Emmy-winning series allows you to follow the experts through the complete renovation process, from beginning to jaw-dropping end. This Old House, now on Thursdays at 8 on WGBH 44.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Last week has not been a terrific one for the First Amendment, for civil liberties, and for government transparency. First off, there's New York Times reporter James Risen. Ordered to testify in a CIA leaker case, Risen thought he could avoid outing one of the sources. It turns out even as a reporter, his First Amendment privileges may not apply. Risen can either testify and incriminate a source or go to jail. Today, there are closing arguments in the Bradley Manning case. In case you don't remember, he's the former intelligence analyst who's facing 21 counts of leaking documents about the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan to WikiLeaks. And then, of course, there's Edward Snowden, the NSA leaker, who's been in limbo at a Moscow airport for a month, is close to being granted asylum by Russian authorities. Now, put all this against the backdrop of yesterday's big news out of Washington. The House of Representatives narrowly defeated a proposal to restrict NSA's phone surveillance program, which, of course, was the one exposed by Snowden. Here with us to make sense, we hope, of this convergence is Christopher Lydon. He joins us every Thursday on Open Mic. Hello there, Chris.
Hello, Jim. Hello, Marjorie.
Hi, Chris.
How can we get from porta-potties to the soul of the Republic?
It's up to you. We'll see.
0 to 60.
Yeah.
I hope so. It's important. And I think, especially in media, we have to think, try to think like citizens. This is not sort of an industrial our industry question. You mentioned them. James Risen is talking at the press, National Press Club as we speak, sort of a whistleblower's summit on why he cannot, will not, should not, must not reveal his source in the CIA case. It's an important issue. Closing arguments, as you said, in Bradley Manning. To me, the fascinating issue is this charge of aiding the enemy. That's not a...
Which is a term of art, by the way.
It's a term of art. It's you can be hung for it. It connotes, obviously, sort of taking arms or critical information to Al-Qaeda or the Nazis or something. What it means in this case is that he told stuff to the New York Times. The government is saying, well, Osama bin Laden could read that, therefore nail him. That's aiding the enemy. This is a huge stretch, and the wonderful Yochai Benkler at the Berkman Center at Harvard says, if you can be charged with aiding the enemy for leaking to the New York Times, it's the end of critical reporting on national security issues.
By the way, we should just make clear in the Bradley Manning case, his contention obviously is that he had no intention
right.
that any of this information, it may have been naive, would ever end up in the hands of Al-Qaeda. But continue.
Well, unless they paid $2 for a copy of the...
No, but that's his defense. I'm not evaluating his defense. That's what his lawyers are saying.
We'll come to Bradley Manning. To me, it's a fascinating story. And it's not really about him, gay, straight, or what matters. You know, similarly with Snowden, who cares whether his girlfriend is a pole dancer? The way we focus on the little tiny personal details about the whistleblowers rather than what they've told us is to me kind of a scandal. I also want to throw in this matter of Michael Hastings. I don't know quite what to say about it because
You should say who he is. He's from of Rolling Stone fame. He's the one who wrote the piece that ultimately led to General McChrystal having had
right.
to step down. Who McChrystal, in this interview off the cuff, criticized the
Obama.
President of the United States and ultimately
wide
had
open
disappear.
Contempt in the barracks for yeah. his commander in chief. Michael Hastings is a kind of a hero, a folk hero of the young. I mean, he was 33 years old. In your face, fight the power, tell it straight. Tell him everything kind of journalism. And he is killed in a brand new exploding Mercedes-Benz in Culver City at 4 o'clock in the morning. He was said to drive like, you know, your grandmother.
You're suspicious.
Well, I don't know what to think. I try not to be paranoid. But the online media is just, you know, full of dark suspicion. If it happened in Pakistan, we'd say the deep state took him out because he knew too much, or the military wanted to get even, or something.
So we've got all these things going on here. But is it? Are we going to blame Obama for this? I mean, many people are saying that he is not exactly Mr. First Amendment, Mr. Freedom of the
well,
Press.
Well, let's talk about it. To me, this lead story in the Times today about the vote in the House is completely fascinating, and this is where, you know, the Snowden era registers in politics. Finally, a very, very close vote as to, taking back, stripping the NSA of authority to monitor, get megadata, dragnet everybody's phone calls, whether you're under suspicion or not, whether you're charged with anything. To me,
totally, but we should say totally bipartisan, conservative Republicans, liberal Democrats. And I think most people, I would say, Christopher, even 2 months ago, would have said if there was ever a vote on a national security item like surveillance of phone calls by the NSA, the notion that the proponents of scaling it back could get 205 votes was preposterous, which suggests that I was wrong when I said to you a month ago when we talked about this, public sentiment is moving in the direction of we don't want you to intrude more than you have to.
Well, you know, this goes back to a conversation we had in the winter about Rand Paul fighting the drone strikes.
Drones, sure.
And he's a Tea Party Republican. You know, yesterday it was I wouldn't call it nonpartisan, Jim. I'd say it's a sort of contrapartisan, or there's a new alignment. It was, you know, the venerable, aged, iconic liberal Ron Dellums with a guy from Western.
John Conyers.
What did I say?
John Conyers. Yeah.
John Conyers. I'm sorry.
From Michigan.
Forgive me. John Conyers and this guy from Western Michigan, another Tea Party libertarian Republican named Justin Amash, they were together against Nancy Pelosi, Barack Obama, John Boehner.
John Boehner, right.
I mean, they called it the Wingnut Coalition against the Power Coalition or the Authoritarian Coalition. Wingnuts, I say with certain respect and affection. But this, I think, is a portrait of the emerging alignment. And there's a real rebellion here. And I must say, as I did with Rand Paul, I take huge encouragement from it. People are sort of waking up. Like, what in the world is this about? What is the substance of these stories that have been revealed? And why in the world, just because it can be done, are we letting the NSA learn absolutely everything about...
You know what's most heartening about this to me? Again, the debate you and I had, maybe it was more than a month ago, and maybe it was at the time we talked about drones, was I said that while I am totally with you, Chris Lydon, in terms of your concerns, I think the American people don't care about this at all. You said you were wrong, Jim. The beauty of what happened in Congress to me is this. It isn't like some great leader, you just listed a bunch of them, were moving people in some direction. Virtually no leaders in the traditional sense have been on the side of this is far too much intrusion. Essentially, the people rose up, I usually don't use that expression, and told their members in Congress, we really care about this, and members of Congress apparently responded.
Yeah, there are a few brave souls out there. I mean, Ron Wyden,
from Oregon.
Democrat of Oregon, you'd have to say, has been a leader. But you're right. We take these House votes on unpredictable, unlobbied, well, not that they weren't lobbied, but sort of unprecast questions to be something like the voice of the people. And, of course, it was fascinating. Michelle Bachmann was for the NSA yesterday, mm-hmm. and with the president. Gerald Nadler of New York, traditional New York liberal, is against the NSA.
He's against Anthony Weiner, too, by the way. He said that Anthony Weiner should see a psychiatrist, but that's a whole other...
He did,
literally, yesterday. That's
a voice
a whole other
of
issue.
Good sense from Manhattan. what else do we need? But, you know, James Sensenbrenner, Republican from Wisconsin, mm-hmm. virtually the father of the Patriot Act, he was saying, no, the time has come to stop the NSA. You know, enough of the surveillance state. So there's a huge reshuffling underway, and, you know,
and also
I joke about the soul of the Republic being tested, but maybe it is. Certainly the soul of robust free speech, of a kind of print the news and be damned attitude, which is us at our best, and certainly the soul of the last shred of privacy in the digital age. And we're going to be held responsible for these issues long after, I think, Anthony Weiner is forgotten. Maybe even Prince George. I don't know.
Never going to forget Prince George. But there was a piece, I forget it was in the Times or the Globe, somebody had a piece this week talking about people trying to rejigger their computers to make them more difficult for good luck. Yeah.
Come
well,
on.
I mean, there's a lot of hackers, a lot of smart hackers running around here, especially over at MIT and stuff like that. They can make it a little bit more difficult for people to get.
Yeah, I'd be curious to hear what, if people want to join us at 877-301-8970, what this thing would have done, this Amash, the Republican from Michigan, and Conyers, a Democrat from Michigan, what it would have done is would have restricted the collection of records, you know, metadata, the term we learned, to only when there's a connection to a relevant ongoing investigation. And I'm curious to know if you would have wanted your member of Congress to support that thing, or if you are still part of that constituency that says, listen, whatever this government does, when it says it is in the name of keeping us safe, is A-okay with me. 877-301-8970. By the way, the polls are moving in the direction you said they were going to move in also, Chris Lydon. Numbers are growing exponentially in terms of people voicing objections about this level of intrusion.
But there are also people who don't like the idea of the government snooping on them, but have sort of come to terms with the fact that almost nothing online is private. I mean, you hear that
anyway,
constituency too. Yeah, that whatever you put out there is totally gettable. And I think a lot of parents say that to their children, you know, especially with looking for jobs and so forth. Don't put anything online you wouldn't want your grandmother to see. And I think that they've internalized that.
Chris, can you play Shrink on the radio for a second? I know you're not in real life. What is motivating? Oh, I've talked to a lot of civil libertarians who voted for Obama, loved much of Obama, who said that he's as bad on these issues as any president in recent memory. Why has Barack Obama been so tough on these First Amendment, these leakers, whether
and
they're
the
press?
Boys, it's a complete mystery to me, and you wonder who inside. I mean, does Eric Holder have a secret passion about whistleblowers? Does Obama himself? I don't know. Does he have a sponsor? Does he have an old grudge? I can't believe it. It's, to me, a great mystery. And I also think, you know, he does it at tremendous cost to his reputation. I mean, let's be real. Among people I know, there's a huge disenchantment with the man for his ability to speak clearly. Little case in point, and maybe this is beside the point, but, you know, in his extraordinary and in many ways wonderful race speech, he didn't make the jump to see himself as the kind of George Zimmerman of Yemen, the guy who, in the name of the U.S. government, sends predator drones to blow away people, including Americans, who for whom, you know, we haven't seen the whites of their eyes, we haven't made a charge, we haven't heard the case, we don't know them. There's this kind of racial profiling in our drone war that a man of Obama's imagination and experience and literary ability ought to be able to see. There's a dulling of the mind and the edge of our president that I leaves me at a huge loss.
Let's take some phone calls. Jim from Attleboro, you're on the phone with Christopher Lydon. We're talking obviously about the NSA, the vote yesterday. Edward Snowden, what do you think, Jim?
I was just calling because I just called my congressman. I'm out of Attleboro, and Joe Kennedy couldn't. The office of Joe Kennedy couldn't even tell me whether or not he voted for or against the bill last night. And so I just think it's something to be said about, you know, Massachusetts is a pretty liberal state, and we have a president you earlier said is not Mr. First Amendment. Well, I don't find him to be Mr. First, Second, or Fourth Amendment, and it's a pretty precarious position for the president to be in. You know, he's willing to get on TV and trash our justice system and the right of a person to be tried by jury, but he doesn't feel like it's necessary to stand up for the freedoms that we already are guaranteed.
Interesting point. What do you mean that Joe Kennedy's office didn't know how he'd voted?
He said the person in the office told me that he's not allowed to say.
No.
So, and then I would have to look up. That's what he told me. He said I would have to look it up online. And he's not allowed to stay for some reason. And I thought I told him I thought that was strange.
Lord, it's worse.
Let's he told you to call the NSA.
Sorry. You have to hope that was a summer intern or something that was a little bit over their head.
Call Browdy and Egan. That was a good move.
Thank you for the call, Jim. Let's talk to Mark from Somerville. Hi, Mark. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. Hi. First, I just want to say how much I love you, Mr. Browdy, on the radio and the television. I think you're one of the few people who are actually talking about the issues that are there, that are really important.
It's very kind of you.
Wow.
Thank you so much.
I guess he doesn't
want
to talk about the little prince either.
I don't put the tax holiday in that category. But
okay.
That aside,
by the way, before you continue, if I may, for the first caller, Joe Kennedy was amongst the 217 people who voted no yesterday, which may be why they didn't want to answer the question. I'm sorry. Continue, if you would.
Okay. Mark, yep.
It's not surprising to me that Barack Obama is so far to the right on this issue. I mean, first of all, when you're in charge, you always choose security over freedom because you get blamed for what happened. And, you know, so that's not surprising. And it's not surprising because the interests
Barack Obama represents are still, you know, the traditional business interests in the country. They're just, you know, different people. So it doesn't surprise me that he stands there. You know, there's just not that much difference between Democrats and Republicans on these issues, sadly. Free speech, you know, I would like my congressman to vote for less intrusion. Capuano.
Capuano voted with the losing side, the anti-intrusion side.
Yeah, still the rising side, we believe.
Yeah,
and I have to say this, you know, I wasn't a big fan of him when he was the mayor of Somerville, but I find that he is a man who actually listens to his constituents and will rethink the position based on what people have to say to him. Because I saw him over the war in Afghanistan, when he was on the opposite side from the delegation, I came and talked to him. And 2-3 weeks later, he changed his position based on what he had heard from us, which I was very impressed by.
Thank you for the call very much, Mark. Can we talk a little bit about the New York Times case with James Risen, which, of course, he's been ordered to testify in the CIA leaker case? It seems to me, Christopher Lydon, and you've been a reporter forever, that we don't quite know what to do about reporters and protecting their sources. And many people have said for years there needs to be some definitive decision here. Can you protect your sources or can't you protect your sources?
We don't know, and we don't know yet quite how we felt about Judith Miller and her sources.
Yeah.
And she did jail time.
But it's a very
sources.
Important thing, obviously, because if people cannot be, if you can't be trusted as a reporter to keep confidential someone whose information would cause them huge crises in their lives, they're not going to talk to you. I mean, it's a fairly obvious point. So what do we do about this? This comes up over and over and over again, nationally and locally.
Right. And I'm not going to solve it, Margie, but I think it does matter. You know, it does matter the scale of the case, the importance of the case, and the sort of the truth of the testimony. In the case of Judith Miller, you know, her sources were leading her and us astray.
Yes.
In the case of
this is the Iraq War.
In the Iraq War and the buildup
and
Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction or whatever. In the case of James Risen and blowing the whistle on the NSA massive surveillance, unauthorized, you know, unwarranted or warrantless, as they said. That was a hugely important story. I think somebody in the CIA, and there are lots of defectors and people out later, know that there is a risk that they could be in deepest trouble for revealing something important, and they have to make a judgment. And I think we as readers and the courts too have to make judgments. What's the scale of the thing? Two examples. I mean, in the New York Times today is a full page and to me fascinating ad. Signed by the likes of Daniel Berrigan and Alice Walker, Ray McGovern, formerly of the CIA, Daniel Berrigan, Noam Chomsky, et cetera, Shepard Fairey, the
artist,
hope artist, saying we are Bradley Manning, and making right from the beginning saying in a time of endless war and economic distress, a cloud of government secrecy has eclipsed our republic. This guy told us what the government knows, what inside people know, and that we're not allowed to know. This is a massive sort of compromise of our democratic fundamental right to know. And I think Bradley Manning knew that he was putting himself on the line, but it was worth it. I take him as a man of his word.
No, he's 25 years old. He could be in jail forever. That's a big sacrifice.
That's true.
You're not saying that any disclosure of information that is secured, top secret, whatever you want to call it. You're not saying that any disclosure unilaterally by someone who doesn't have the authority to do it should be protected.
No.
You're saying in this case.
No, and I, you know, Anthony Lewis, our late great friend, was a convert to the notion that reporting the First Amendment and newspapers do not have an absolute privilege. Neither has the New York Times ever asserted an absolute privilege. They held that James Risen story out of the paper for a year. And they weighed it very, very carefully against their own judgment of the public interest. I think these kinds of judgments have to be made by responsible institutions outside the government, and they have to take it be given it with respect. But
can I interrupt one second just to say, because the guy raised an interesting point. I am missing one member of Congress, and my apologies. Maybe you guys, when I read the list, can say Joe Kennedy voted against this proposal to restrict NSA phone tracking. Capuano, Keating, Tierney, Neal, McGovern, Tsongas, and Lynch voted for it. I'm missing one Massachusetts member of Congress. I can't think of who it is. But essentially, 7 out of the 8 that I could think of voted to restrict the NSA phone tracking.
Joe How about Kennedy. Lynch?
Lynch voted to restrict it. So there's only one I'm missing. I just can't remember what it is. Let's take another I'm sorry.
Can I make just one other line? The figure that keeps coming to mind in the Snowden-Manning case is Muhammad Ali. I mean, there was a man who put his heavyweight title and his livelihood, his reputation on the line because, as he said, you know, ain't no Viet Cong called him the N-word. Why would he be going into that war? It was an extremely controversial and brave judgment. We honor him now as we honor none of those politicians of that era for putting everything on the line and being vindicated. It is beyond imagining to me that Bradley Manning will someday be reviled as some sort of Nathan Hale traitor to his country. No, he was an innocent dude who'd been bullied all his life, a kid from Oklahoma who saw unconscionable things happening under his watch and said, the world will be a better place when the American people debate these questions. I think he's ready to pay a price. He doesn't have a heavyweight title to give up, but he'll pay a price. On the other hand, I think we have to sort of see the long... It puzzles me. It depresses me why we allow the momentary issues. Oh, well, he's violating security. He broke a rule. He broke the law, as President Obama says. And not see what he's talking about and what he is sacrificing.
Well, I don't think these sacrifices on a personal level matters, but obviously the issue is what is he disclosing? Incidentally, one of our colleagues pointed out the missing 9th congressman is a missing congressman. Ed Markey's seat was vacant at the still is vacant. There's obviously an election. Let's try to squeeze in one more call. Steve from Falmouth, you're on with Christopher Lydon. We're obviously talking about the First Amendment. Hi, Steve.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Pleasure.
Two quick things. First, I think you're wrongly conflating the term whistleblower with the thought of someone who releases secrets about something that are not illegal. And two, I think that...
Are you saying that all that NSA intrusion was at least technically or in some manner arguably not illegal?
I believe so. I mean, I haven't followed that closely, but I haven't heard anyone say that it's illegal, just that it's undesirable.
Could it be illegal? Could it be technically illegal and grossly unconstitutional at the same time, which I think it is?
Possibly.
Okay.
But I also want to say one quick thing about that. That there, I think a lot of the public do not understand what the NSA was doing. That the collection of the call records, for instance, allowed them to check immediately after the Boston Marathon bombing to see who Tsarnaev et al. Were in communication with.
Wait, give us that one more time, please.
And no, I get it. The Tsarnaev brothers were properly checkable, but then again, they were not.
Well, the older Tsarnaev was properly checkable,
right? And but the Russians and the FBI and lots of other authorities were on notice that this kid could be trouble. And I suppose there was, if any surveillance of anybody could be justified, it would be surveillance of him.
And by the way, and the reason that obviously matters more than as an abstract principle is had they done their job, at least in the minds of some of us, then obviously April 15th at the marathon might not have happened. Steve, thank you so much for your call. And Chris Lydon, thank you as always for stopping by.
It's a pleasure.
It is a pleasure for us too.
Christopher Lydon is the man behind RadioOpenSource.org, and he joins us as he did today every Thursday for Open Mic at 1 o'clock. Tune in tomorrow at 1 o'clock for Open Mic with Emily Rooney. And up next, Kara Miller joins us to discuss the technology paradox, how advances in technology have made life both easier and harder, and how all you multitaskers out there think you're doing beautifully. Maybe not. This is 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
This summer, there's one place where Afropop meets Spanish bagpipe meets Celtic reels.
The Boston Summer Arts Weekend After Dark. No eyes to hang. Friday night, July 26th.
New Orleans legend Dr. John.
Then on Saturday the 27th,
Angelique Kidjo.
Presented by Citizens Bank.
Check out the entire lineup and reserve your spot now at bostonsummerarts.com.
WGBH programs exist because of you. And the Lincoln Motor Company, introducing the 2013 MKZ Hybrid, a luxury car with an EPA estimated rating of 45 city miles per gallon. More at lincoln.com. Actual mileage will vary. And the Boston Speaker Series, presented by Lesley University, offering 7 evenings at Symphony Hall with a lineup of speakers that includes a prime minister, a Pulitzer Prize winner, a humorist, and even a former spy. BostonSpeakerSeries.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. So if you think you're getting more done, as I do, by multitasking, brace yourself for some really bad news. You're not. Here with us to elaborate on the myth of multitasking. It hurts me just to even say the words. Among other frustrating truths is Kara Miller. She's the woman behind the Innovation Hub. Hey, Kara.
Hey. You know, I would take multitasking out of your vocabulary. There is no such thing. There is only toggling back and forth between things. People who think they're getting two things done at one time or not. Have you ever had the experience I have when I've been at home and I've been watching Jon Stewart or something and all of a sudden, you know, my husband would be like, "Aha, that's hilarious." And I have no idea what the joke was because I was like also writing an email. But I totally thought I was there, and I have no idea what's going
on. How do they know this? Yeah, but this is I am one. Marjorie and I have had this fight for 5 years.
That's
and by
right.
The way,
and guess who's proven right
okay,
today?
Okay, fine. You might be. When we talk multitasking, we're talking about in media. We're not, as one of the articles you gave us, we're not talking about, you know, cooking dinner for your kids while you're watching, doing something, whatever it is. This is within the world of media. How do they prove that the brain can't do two things at once well?
There's a bunch of ways of doing it. So there's one really interesting study that was done at Carnegie Mellon. They took about 130 people, divided them up into three groups. One, they said, okay, you're going to read this and just go do that. And the other two groups, they said, listen, somebody may call you. Here's a phone. Somebody may call you, but go read this. The people who were called in the middle actually turned out to be 20% dumber than the people. I mean, you know, they did not do – that's enough to take you from an 80 to like, you know, a 62. I mean, you're not doing that well if you're – so, okay. So that's, you know, that's one thing right there. That's one way you test people. And then, interestingly, they had the people do it again. And the group – The same group that, you know, didn't get interrupted again. Then you had the two groups that got interrupted. Well, the second time, the one group that had gotten interrupted got interrupted again. But the other group was told somebody might call you, but they never did. The group that got interrupted did terribly. But the group that was told they might get interrupted but didn't did actually quite well. And they explain this by thinking that our brains adapt. So the group that might get interrupted, they know, like, I really, really better focus. I've only got a few minutes. Somebody could call at any time. I've really, really got to focus here. And they really did. In fact, they outperformed the people who didn't have any interruptions at all.
So how do you explain? I'm sorry.
You know, this is so true. And I can't believe that anybody would ever doubt it. Because if you have to write something, and you have to write something in 45 minutes, you've really got to focus and concentrate, and it's very hard. It is like running a marathon in your head in some ways. You really have to focus. You can't be checking your emails every 15 minutes or taking phone calls because you just can't do it. And you over here that's always saying, oh, yeah.
Who are you pointing at?
You.
Thank
you're
you.
Texting, you're emailing, you're Skyping, you got the app for this, you got the app for that. I mean, you're toggling, as you say, you're going from one thing to the other, and you're not sustaining. And I don't think you're training your brain to do that kind of sustain, concentrating that you need to do, as these stories point out, to read great, deep literature, never mind write it.
You're totally right. And in fact, Marjorie, the scary thing is that writing emails is coming to cars. So we can get to that in a minute. But I have a question for you, Jim.
Yeah, go ahead.
Do you feel like you do well at multitasking?
Well, this is what I was going to bring up next. When I read this portion of the stuff you gave us to say that people who are bad at multitasking think they're good at multitasking? I was enraged. The answer is yes, I think. I am very good at multitasking.
Yes.
That's typical, right? Denial, apparently.
How many
part
times
of
do you check your email a day?
I mean, I'm not atypical. I check my email probably hundreds of times. I do. Everybody
I do
does.
Too.
Of course
I do.
They
do.
Everybody does not.
Yes, they do. So why is it that people think they're good at it if all the evidence suggests that they're not?
Here's the scary thing. The people who are high media multitaskers, people who are used to going back and forth between different screens, this really pioneering guy at Stanford who I talked to, Cliff Nass, actually tested them against low media multitaskers, so people who go back and forth between different screens not very often. It turns out the high media multitaskers are actually worse at multitasking than the low media multitaskers. I'm sorry, Jim. I'm like a fountain of depressing news.
What did
today.
She say? I was emailing somebody. Our numbers are 877. Our one number is 877-301-8970. We're mostly looking for multitaskers or ex-multitaskers. We want to know: do you do it? Do you think you do it well? And are you convinced that your brain doesn't have the ability, as Kara and the researchers believe it doesn't? What's a pancake person? I read that in one
I
of the
pieces,
I love
that.
Too.
That's what we are, pancake people.
We're pancake people.
Spread, wide, right, and thin.
Right, in other words, like a mile wide and an inch deep. And there's another great line. I'm sorry to keep quoting from all this stuff. Multitaskers, and I have to say, I am here. Multitaskers love irrelevancy, one of these people said. And it is true. When I'm thinking about it this morning in anticipation of you coming, it is true. All of these things that have nothing to do with where I'm trying to go are the things that stay in my head.
Well, you know, I mean, I have to say, to be confessional here, the reason I wanted to really look into this is because I myself, I mean, I feel drowned by emails. Everybody, you know, is. They're triaging their email inbox.
Yes.
Cliff Nass from Stanford told me that people pay him, companies pay him to come in and help their employees deal with email. And so he'll say, you know what, you need to set aside, you know, every few hours, 20 minutes where people do nothing but email. And the companies will be horrified. They'll be like, what? I don't want people spending 20 minutes on email. And he'll be like, great. Why don't I come in with some scientists and we will clock how much time people spend on email. 150 minutes. Right. So, you know, people totally underestimate.
In one day?
Yes. Yes. And so anyway, so I mean, what I do, like when I'm getting ready for a big interview or something, I have to this is sad. This is a sad, sad story. I have to like sequester myself. I will go somewhere else in the building, find a room that has no technology, not bring my phone, not bring my computer, and read somebody's
it's
book.
It's not sad. It's not sad. That's what you have to do. I mean, I know this from writing for a living. That's what you have to do, or it's not going to be as good as it can
but
be.
Isn't it kind of addictive to sit in front of your computer? You're like, I wonder if somebody emailed me and might need me right now, or
exactly.
I wonder if somebody texted me. Something must be going on out there that I should know about. And it's only getting away from that stuff that helps
Kara,
me.
Kara, can I just tell you something?
Yes.
It's almost like Marjorie shouldn't be part of this discussion. Here's a typical afternoon after the show. I'll get a phone call and I'll say, oh, Jim, I'm really sorry. I got a voicemail, a message from you. What do you want? And I said, well, I don't want anything. I wanted something 8 days ago when I left you. Now, here's one more theory of mine that is totally unscientific, and then we'll get to your calls at 877-301-8970. We're mostly looking for multitaskers or ex-multitaskers. We learn through evolution. The brain can do incredible things. I am of the opinion, or at least I want to be of the opinion, that even if you're right, that the more we multitask in the world of media, our brain will adapt to that and will be more able to do 2, 3, 4 things at once. Why am I not right?
I mean, I think it's possible that there's some of that going on. There's a lot of evidence to show, for example, that people who read articles online with links understand less about the content of the article than people who, you know, rather the people who read it with links are very distracted. The people who read an article without links tend not to be distracted. There's evidence that shows that people tend to be interrupted about every 11 minutes when they're at work, except that it takes you 25 minutes to really get deeply into a task. I think it's possible, not that we're not getting things done, but that the things that we are getting done lack some of the really deep reflective thinking. I mean,
well, that's what the college professors are saying about their kids. I mean, I thought this was a fascinating and very depressing part of the research we were doing for this, that a kid will write a paragraph and then go on Facebook for 15 minutes, reward themselves, and then go back and write another paragraph and then go back on Facebook again. So they're not getting I mean, I look at especially my youngest kid, who's like a little gerbil there with the texting all the time and the Facebook all the time, and I worry that she's not going to be able to muster the you feel like it's almost a workout for your head. And if you don't train your head to get that deep concentration, then you're not going to be able to do it. And that's, I mean, I'll shut up.
So is the moral of the story, Kara, that people should do what you did or you say when you have to prepare for a major interview, that essentially because so many of us are addicted or pretty close to addicted, and I would consider myself, I mean, I think I'm in that boat and you may be pretty close, that you do have to consciously segregate yourself, be as unwired as you can possibly be to get something done well. Is that the notion?
I think so. You know, it's interesting. There's a school in Silicon Valley, the Waldorf School, and well, there's Waldorf schools all over, but it doesn't have any technology in it. And here's the interesting thing about the school. The kids in it are all the children, or mostly the children, of the executives of eBay.
That's great.
And yep.
That is really
That's right.
Great.
And Google. Because I think that these people, these executives, are smart enough, right? They're making millions of dollars a year. This is what their living is made on. But I think they are smart enough to know that if they ever want their kids to be the person who thinks of a great new concept, the next Twitter, you know, they want the – I mean, Google is based on an algorithm. You don't just like churn out an algorithm in 10 minutes, right? So if you want your kid to be somebody who can really think, be reflective, have conversations with people, not always be texting other people, that you are going to have to consciously make that happen. Isn't it fascinating that some of the people at the top of the tech world send their kids to a place where all they do is read and do no technology? I think that's very interesting.
Okay, let's take some phone calls here. Our number is 877-301-8970. I know. I love it. I love every second of it. Giovanni of Boston. What do you think, Giovanni?
Hey, Giovanni.
Oops. Is he there?
We'll put him on. Oh, there he is.
Oh, there he is. Go ahead.
Actually, it might be Sean today, but if you want to call me Giovanni, Jimmy.
Oh, hey, Sean.
Hi, Sean.
Hey, whatever it takes, so, you know, I'm easy.
Go ahead, Sean.
What do you think?
Actually, to go back to your last topic real quick, when someone has to take a deuce, there's no walking in conference like that guy was.
Okay, fine.
Right,
thank you. Thank you for that, Sean.
I had to bring that up.
No, I'm sure you
Listen,
did. Go ahead.
Now, I find these multitaskers pretty funny because they say, oh, I can do two or three things. I find they can't even do one good thing. You know, maybe Marjorie's an example of that. I don't know.
Sean, thank you for your contribution to the program. We appreciate it. Now we're going to Giovanni in Boston. Hi, Giovanni. Giovanni? Or maybe we're not. 877-301. He may be 8970. Should we try Giovanni again or go elsewhere, colleagues? What are we doing? Let's go to Jay in Marshfield. Giovanni, we'll get back to you in a minute. Jay, you're on Boston Public Radio with Kara Miller. Hey, Jay.
This is actually Craig. I think you guys are mixing up.
Sorry. Close enough.
It's okay. Sorry.
You're not multitasking over there, are you?
Go ahead, Craig. Sorry.
Yeah, so basically I do multitask, but I do it when it's low-level functions that I don't necessarily have to make sure they're done 100%. Like, for example, cooking dinner while I'm on the phone and looking at my emails.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily need to focus intently on one of those to get it done. On the other hand, if it's something like, for example, writing a research paper, I actually have a room at a local library that has nothing but a chair, a desk, and a lamp.
I can't believe
I have to focus on that 100%. So I think it depends on what you're doing.
So, Craig, you're saying you have to do exactly what Kara said she had to do for herself. Total segregation from any contact to anything except the work you're on. Craig, thanks for the call.
I think if you're thinking deep thoughts, you know, a few weeks ago we talked about what it takes to be a genius. Remember we talked about sort of these, you know, Maria Montessori and people. You know, I actually asked the woman who I interviewed for that, Dr. Roberta Ness, does she worry that there are not as many big, really, you know, sort of groundbreaking creative thoughts because we are so busy doing all our other things? And she said she worries about it all the time. So it's not that we can't accomplish some things. It's not that we can't do some things, you know, we can't churn stuff out. The question is, are we thinking the really deep thoughts? I mean, that's sort of what it takes. It sort of takes being alone. Sometimes it takes being lonely. I mean, it takes, you know, when we have downtime now, we're like, who could I text? Who could I call? Right? I mean, seriously, you fill that time. But if you don't, if that time is really alone, you may be able to reflect on some of the things that you've got going around in your mind there, and you may be able to think of some things.
The biggest problem is that what we were talking about before, Kara, is the self-delusion. Because the more you're talking, the more I'm saying to myself, I really do feel I'm more productive. I mean, even though I'm sure the evidence would suggest otherwise, when I'm doing three things, I say to myself, even if I'm only at 75% in the three of them, well, three times 75% is about, no, I'm serious. That's the way that I look at it, which obviously is wrong.
But you know what else? I don't mean to, you know, to be outing all your secrets here, but if you respond to email within seconds.
Within seconds.
So that means you're looking all the time.
I might be.
And I think what annoys me about work now is that you're almost looked at as some kind of deadbeat if you're not responding to emails within 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes. But if you do that, then you don't have time to finish the other task you're trying to do.
No, I mean, I've talked to people who run businesses who say that research shows that CEOs who take a little time away actually tend to think bigger thoughts than people who are on call 100% of the time. It doesn't mean they can't write you back. It doesn't mean they can't answer your emails. But the question is, are they doing the big things instead of putting out little fires all the time? Are they sort of moving the ball forward in a really big way? And I don't know that they are.
Okay, we're going to, with great trepidation, we're going to say, welcome to Boston Public Radio, Giovanni from Boston. Let's see how we do. Is this you, Giovanni?
Yeah, it's me.
Oh, great. Hi. Finally. Hi. Thanks for the call.
Yeah, so I want to say that I multitask nonstop. I'm a solo practitioner attorney, and I think I'm horrible at it. And I just wish that I could actually have a time or a day where I could literally line up my tasks one at a time and only do that one task and then do the next one without having to respond to a phone call or an email or a call from the wife with the two kids or a coworker who comes in asking me this or that. I wish that I could just have my day organized in such a fashion.
Now, Giovanni, I have a question for you. Why can't you do that? Why can't you say, okay, from 9 to 10 every day, I'm going to do X, and from 10 to 11, I'm going to do X, and I'm only going to check like email and voicemail and stuff at the top of the hour every hour?
Well, because there's just too many fires to perpetually put out. You know, there's too much stuff going on where it's like I get a notification from a district attorney that I have to respond to right away because I got court in a few days, whatever it is, and I just there's always one thing that piles up on top of something else while I'm working on something. So you know, what it's worked out for me is that just bring on more and more staff to try to help me, you know, work through all this because I feel like I'm such a poor multitasker.
And I think, don't you think the expectation now, like I said before, is that you are going to respond really quickly.
That is true.
And if you're not, then you're somehow, like I said, a deadbeat.
Yeah, see, I think what's...
Giovanni, thanks.
I think what Giovanni's saying is so interesting. He's not saying, I want my own island or I want a Maserati. He's saying, I just want my day back. And you would think he would have control over that, but he feels like he doesn't. Now, I'm not sure that that's true, but I know exactly how he feels. Very often, I know I shouldn't be checking my email for like the 50th time that day, but I am, and I don't know why I am. But, you know, I talked to Sherry Turkle from MIT, who has done some great stuff on this, and she talks about our relationship with tech. Like, she says we're like young lovers. We want to know that we're needed all the time.
Well, you know, to follow up on that and what Giovanni said and Marjorie said, too, it's because the expectation is exactly as he described. You know, you might listen to Giovanni and say, he's deluding himself just like I am deluding myself. But the flip side, I'm thinking as he's speaking, if I send an email to someone, which matters to me, the subject matter matters to me, and I check my email nonstop like I do, and I don't get a fairly rapid response, I immediately draw the worst conclusion.
Okay.
That Jane Doe or John Doe
or
either
Marjorie
doesn't like the idea. No, you, I figure you've lost your computer or something. But, no, I'm serious. And so there is that level of expectation Marjorie's talking about, Giovanni's talking about.
Yeah, but I think it's an addiction beyond that. Don't you think that if somebody emailed you back within an hour, that would be adequate for you?
Maybe, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So why don't you check your email just once an hour?
I can't do that.
Exactly.
Sorry.
That's what I'm saying.
That gave me hives just hearing you suggest that.
That's what I'm saying. I think people think people want to be able to do things, but they can't. And I have to say, when it comes to driving, you were talking about driving before, the stuff is frightening, these statistics. So there was recent studies on what we can accomplish while we're driving. Just talking on the phone, which is by no means the most distracting thing you can do while you're driving, is like having a 0.08 blood alcohol level. Mm. I mean, that's a scary thing.
Jay from Marshfield, are you a multitasker and feel like you're failing, Jay, or not?
Hi, Jay.
Yes, I feel like I'm failing.
I'm sorry.
I multitask and have to do it and don't like it. I find it very stressful. I also find that I'm doing kind of a superficial job in the things that I multitask, and that if anything needs to be carefully or thoughtfully done, I've pretty much got to isolate myself and stop all of the outside stimulation.
Another one, just like you, Kara.
Yeah.
Jay, thank you for the call. And by the way, Jay said, I hadn't added that to my list of woes. I'm like Jay in that regard. I do feel the stress. Well, I can't get away from multitasking, and I do delude myself into believing it's working. The more I'm doing, the more stress is created because you are trying to balance so many bowls.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, isn't that what addiction is, that you can't be in the same room with something without needing it and wanting it, that you actually have to go find some other part of the building, some other building, get in your car, go somewhere else? I mean, isn't that the definition of addiction, that everybody says, I can't, I have to sequester myself. It's the only way I can handle technology.
Get away from the booze and the drugs.
But the problem is, I'm thinking, again, as you guys are speaking, I'm saying, okay, I'll try the Kara approach. And that causes me stress. The contemplation of locking myself away to prepare for something where theoretically, based on all this research, I'll do better, that gives me great anxiety. So what do I do with that?
I don't know. I mean, I think I do it because I have to do it. I mean, I can't have like a 40-minute conversation with somebody about the book they wrote and not read their book. Marjorie, you're partially doing it right because you write a column and you can't like not produce the column and you don't want it to be junk.
Well, you just know that if you don't sit down and block everything out and think, it's going to be a bad column because you're just not going to be able to concentrate enough to make it a good column. I also find that doing shoulder stands, get that blood in your head. Mm. It's very useful too, but that's a different subject, isn't it? But keep that in mind next time you're doing it.
I'm working on doing a sit-up first, Marjorie, and then I'll get to the shoulders.
You just put like something under your butt and put your legs up and it helps. I'm serious.
No, I'm sure it does for you.
I am serious.
Madeline, you're in Arlington. You're on with Marjorie Egan, Jim Brody, and Kara Miller. Hey, Madeline.
Hi, how are you?
Excellent, thank you. I'm getting stressed, but fine otherwise. Hi.
Hi. One thing is that I tune out all electronics because there's no peace in it. I do not take the phone on the dog walk. I have to separate myself. My friends hate me because I don't check my email but once a week. If it's that important, then
What do you do for a living, Madeline?
So, yeah, I work at the post office. We are not allowed to have our cell phones on anymore because too many people were talking. It takes maybe an hour and a half, 2 hours to set up your route, and you'd have some people on the phone the whole time. Checking Facebook, texting. You can't text and drive, obviously. They've done away from that. But they had to stop cell phone use at the post office altogether because I find if people call me and I try to deliver the mail, I get agitated because I cannot do those two things at once.
Well, Madeline, you're a well-somethinged woman, well-adjusted woman. Thank you for the call.
You know, Stephen says he gets so anxiety-ridden if he doesn't get an email for an hour that he starts sending himself messages to make sure that everything
he's still
is
alive,
working.
That he's okay, checking in with himself.
But you do see that. People doing, I mean, I do that, take the dog for a walk with a cell phone, or the people at dinner, like couples even now at dinner where they're both on their phones.
I know. It's like, what's the point of going out together? You're really there with other people.
Yeah, but that's
anyway.
A whole other issue. I mean, that issue, when you're doing a non-media related thing, I'm not advocating for it, whether it's walking the dog or going out to dinner or having a conversation or whatever it is. It seems to me those things you can mix better. You shouldn't.
Well,
you can't.
Well,
you
people
can focus,
have their phones
you can't focus
on
walking
the
dog and doing
no.
and
oh,
talking
yeah,
on the phone.
No, yeah, that's fine, but people have their phones on the table.
No, it's gross. I agree.
And I think that's because they have to be in touch.
I was
going to
say, I think that's an indication of how attached they are to that maybe something's going on without them. It's interesting. Sherry Turkle from MIT talks about playground accidents being up because parents take their phone to the playground. Their kids play. Once in a while, they'll be like, Mommy, Mommy. And the parent will look up and be like, that's great, honey. Go back to texting.
They don't see their kid falling
off the jungle gym.
As a quick aside, my kids were so old that there weren't cell phones and that you would be forced to engage with the children at the park with the sand and the swings and everything else. It's totally different now. You know this as a young mom. Everybody's on their phones.
Oh, yeah.
At the park.
And Cherry Trickle also talked about this idea of the pass back, which has become something that people do with kids as young as 2 years old. She'll be driving in the car and the kid's like, and people be like, okay, great, play with my iPhone.
So,
it becomes like this pacifier too. I mean, I think there's a real question about what happens to a kid who doesn't really learn how to have conversations. You know, they grow up and everybody's looking down, texting.
You know, human interaction is so yesterday. Kara.
I know.
It's really kind of
overrated.
You're going to have to get with the programming. You're never going to get anywhere in life. Now, Kara Miller, every week we say to you, what are you doing on Innovation Hub tonight at 9 and Saturday at 10? And more often than not, you have no idea. Do you know this week?
Do you know what you're doing this week? It is. It's because I'm trying to be on this show. And I mean, you're asking a lot from me.
What's happening this
week?
Okay.
So this Saturday is the conversation we're talking about
now.
Oh, great. Sherry Turkle, Nicholas Carr, who wrote the Pulitzer Prize nominated book, The Shallows.
The
how the internet is changing our brains. He actually wrote it because he realized he couldn't read novels anymore. And, like 2 pages in the novel, he'd be like, I wonder if somebody's emailing me right now.
And that's how shallow we are. Is that the title?
Yeah,
the shallowest. Yeah. Okay.
And Cliff Nass, who did this pioneering
work. That's 10
work.
Saturday.
That's 10 o'clock on Saturday.
To be missed.
Tonight at 9 o'clock is Adam Grant talking about givers and takers and how, as it turns out, givers very often get ahead in life. It's kind of amazing.
We talked to him. We love him, too. We'll be listening tonight at 9 o'clock on Innovation Hub with Kara Miller. Saturday morning, 10. Kara, it's great to see you. Thanks so much
for
your
time. Good to be here.
Thanks for you guys listening, too. Tomorrow, open mic with Emily Rooney. And our Friday news quiz is, I guess you'd call it Secretary's Day. It features the Massachusetts Secretary of Education against the Massachusetts Secretary of Public Safety. That should be a good one. Matt Malone, Andrea Cabral, hope you're there for that. I am Jim Browdy.
I am Marjorie Egan.
Have a great day, and we'll see you and hear you tomorrow at noon. Bye.